March 4th, 2009 meeting of the Senate Committee on Commerce and Workforce Development to order. And I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 519. And Jeremy, would you please tell us about this bill briefly?
Madam Chair and committee members, Senate Bill 519 prohibits adverse employment action against employees for failure to participate in employer-sponsored meetings or communication about religious or political matters. It creates employee civil cause of action. It requires the employer to post notice of the employee rights, and it provides exceptions for religious or political organizations and for legally required or voluntary meetings or communications.
Thank you. And members, we have actually a telephone hookup, so we have one witness who is going to be testifying but could not be here in person today, and so he is on the phone with us. So I will start by calling forward Barbara Bird. And Barbara, I think you wanted to go first, and then we also have on the phone Gordon Lafer, who will be our second witness. So when you're ready, please go ahead.
Thank you. Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, my name is Barbara Bird. I'm the Secretary-Treasurer of the Oregon AFL-CIO. The Oregon AFL-CIO represents over 225,000 working Oregonians, and it's the leading voice for health care reform, good jobs, retirement security, and rebuilding the middle class. We appreciate the opportunity to testify today in support of SB 519, the Worker Freedom Act. The Worker Freedom Act is simple and straightforward. It provides working Oregonians with important protections. It gives workers on the job in Oregon the right to leave or not to attend a meeting about politics, union organizing, or religion without the fear of discipline or other retaliation. It allows them, in short, to focus on their primary work responsibilities. Fundamentally, this act will protect workers from being intimidated on the job due to their positions or beliefs on deeply personal issues and decisions. Employers can have meetings whenever they want on whatever topic. They just can't have meetings under this act on politics, on union organizing, and religion that are mandatory or a condition of employment. We believe this act is needed. In Oregon, it's completely legal for employers to have to use mandatory meetings to force employees to listen to their beliefs on organizing, politics, and religion. And worse, it's legal to fire an employee who refuses to attend or doesn't listen or tries to respond. In fact, it's common practice for employers to compel workers to sit through mandatory anti-union presentations during labor organizing campaigns. Research bears this out. A report for the federal government based on a study of more than 400 union representation election campaigns found that during 92% of them, employers forced their employees to attend closed-door anti-union meetings and on average held 11 of these meetings during every union organizing campaign. We also believe there's strong public support for the Worker Freedom Act. In a December 2008 poll that we conducted, by Grove Insight, 88% of registered voters who were surveyed said they did not think workers should be forced to attend mandatory meetings on politics, union organizing, or religion. 84% of them said they would support legislation allowing workers to opt out of these meetings. But you don't have to take my word for it. We have four union members here today to share their stories about being subjected to these mandatory meetings in the workplace. Additionally, there are members who couldn't be here today in person, and we've submitted written testimony from some of them. I just want to say that for every single worker who's here to testify today, there are hundreds of workers who've had to go through this very uncomfortable experience. And so I hope that the stories that they tell you today will be helpful, and I do thank you for this opportunity to testify. And I'd be happy to take questions now, or if you prefer, wait until the rest of the panel has.
I think we'll hold questions until we've heard from the next witness. And members, you should have in front of you a packet that includes Barbara's written testimony, and then attached to it are other written statements. And I think some of those are from the witnesses that we're about to hear from, and some of them, as she just said, are from people who couldn't be here today. So next we will hear from Gordon Lafer, who is joining us by telephone. So Gordon, if you could please go ahead and tell us who you are for the record, and then provide your testimony, and we'll then take some questions.
Certainly. Chair Rosenbaum, Vice Chair Telfer, and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to participate in the hearing. My name is Gordon Lafer. I hold a PhD in political science from Yale University, and I'm currently a professor and acting director at the University of Oregon's Labor Education and Research Center. I'm also the founding co-chair of the American Political Science Association's Labor Project. And I just want to add that I'm particularly appreciative of the committee's flexibility in allowing me to present this testimony by phone after a family medical issue made me unable to come to Salem to testify in person. Over the past 5 years, I've conducted extensive research measuring the extent to which election standards of union elections conducted by the National Labor Relations Board live up to American standards defined from the Founding Fathers to the present for what constitutes a free and fair election. Unfortunately, it turns out that labor board elections look more like the discredited practices of rogue regimes abroad than like anything we'd recognize as American. Today I want to describe just a couple of the problems that plague the labor board election system that I think are particularly relevant to how SB 519 would address those issues. I want to talk just about three things briefly. One is free speech, the second is freedom of voters from economic coercion, and the third is the meaning of the secret ballot and the right to privacy regarding one's political convictions. Before addressing the substance, I just want to say a quick word about secret ballots. It's been a large part of a policy discussion at the federal level around labor board elections, and there have been some who seem to argue that as long as an election ends in a secret ballot, it has to be fair and it doesn't really matter what comes before, that we don't need to be concerned with things like free speech during the conduct of the election campaign as long as at the end of the day you cast your ballot in the privacy of a voting booth. I think it's critical to know that the American democratic tradition from the Founding Fathers to the present fundamentally reject this view. While we obviously require secret ballots, there's a whole set of standards of what has to happen before the day of the vote, like free speech, equal access to the media and voters, and other things which are equally crucial to making an election process fair. And our government, in fact, regularly condemns elections in other countries when there's no question it ended in a secret ballot because they don't meet up to these other standards. The world is full of people, including Saddam Hussein in his time, who have secret ballots and win by 90% of the vote. The way they do that is through things like having a one-party state where the ruling party dominates the media without allowing free debate, forcing people to participate in political partisan events on threat of losing their jobs, and blocking out the opposition from TV, radio, and other mass media. These are essentially things that are very similar to the kinds of problems that SB 519 aims to remedy. When we see this in other countries, we condemn these as sham elections, and I think that there are several important ways in which SB 519 brings workplace operations more into keeping with the American norms of democracy. So let me just briefly try to go through these three points. First, free speech by the Supreme Court, by all of our history of jurisprudence, is the cornerstone of American democracy. And free speech in statute and in litigation includes the freedom that you cannot be forced to listen to political speech. The most extreme restriction on free speech in the workplace is employers forcing workers to attend mass meetings, which certainly in the labor elections tend to be mass anti-union meetings, where pro-union employees are not only given no equal time, but can be forced to attend on condition that they don't open their mouths, and if they ask a question anyway, can be fired on the spot, and all that is legal. If we think about how this would work in politics, if we think, you know, during the 2004 presidential election, if the Bush campaign could have forced every voter in America to watch the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth movie with no opportunity for response from the other side, or if the Democrats could have forced everyone to watch Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11, maybe they would have done it, but none of us would have thought that this was a democratic process. This is the kind of thing that we're trying to avoid through SB 519. A second point that's critical in the American democratic tradition is freedom from economic coercion. When you read the notes from the Constitutional Convention of the United States, when the Founding Fathers were trying to go about creating the world's first democracy, they were very concerned with the potential undue influence of employers over their employees. And for that reason, there's a wide range of both federal and state laws that are aimed specifically to guarantee that employees will not make their political choices out of fear of economic coercion. In Oregon, our own state statute makes it illegal for an employer to terminate an employee or to threaten termination in order to influence an employee's decision about which party or which candidate to vote for. But that law only prohibits firing in order to influence someone's vote. It does not include what SB 519 would consider being fired for not attending a meeting that is a mass meeting with a one-sided partisan message. So in a way, SB 519 is extending the intent of Oregon statute and a federal statute in making sure that American citizens can make political and associative decisions free from fear of economic coercion. The last point I want to address is about the secret ballot. And although labor board elections end in a secret ballot in the sense that you go behind a curtain and nobody sees how you vote, they really violate the heart of the meaning of the secret ballot in American democracy. What the secret ballot means in the American democratic tradition is not that you have a secret ballot just for the 15 seconds that you're behind the voting booth, but that in general you have the right to keep your political opinion to yourself, both before, during, and after the act of casting your ballot. That if somebody knocks on your door and says, hey, can you tell me who you're voting for, you have the freedom to not share that information and to not participate in that conversation. In labor board elections, while you cast your ballot behind a private voting booth, you don't essentially have the right to keep your political opinions to yourself. It's illegal in labor law for an employer to directly ask somebody which way they're voting. But to get around that, all of the management side anti-union consultants, and I've spent years reading through these books, they're not secret, they're publicly available in any library, instruct supervisors to have what they call eyeball-to-eyeball conversations in which they're trained in how to make provocative anti-union statements and then carefully observe their subordinates' body language, listen to their responses, and grade them on a scale of whether they're pro-union or anti-union. And they can repeat those provocative grillings over and over and over again throughout a day or throughout an election campaign until they're sure which way someone is leaning. So if you're an extremely skilled actor or liar, you may be able to deceive your supervisor. But the vast majority of people give up their political leanings in the course of those grillings. And the management side consultants report that they're generally able to predict the final vote in a union election with remarkable accuracy, because even though somebody still votes behind a curtain, management knows how they're going to vote weeks before they ever walk into the voting booth. So that is really making a mockery of what the secret ballot is supposed to mean in the democratic tradition. And really the only way to restore the real meaning of the secret ballot is to do what SB 519 is doing, which is as long as you can be forced into confrontational discussions with the person you're most intimidated by, which is your personal supervisor who has the most control over your work life, as long as you can be forced into those kind of intensive one-on-one grillings, whether it's about union elections or how you're going to vote in an election for public office or your religious feelings or anything else, you don't really have freedom of conscience, because any normal person will be concerned that the answer they give or the feelings that they led on to will affect how their supervisor is going to treat them once their supervisor has made it clear that they themselves have a very strongly felt belief on the issue. So in conclusion, if we're serious about protecting American citizens' freedom of conscience, both at home and in the workplace, we have to guarantee that personal decisions regarding political and associational activity won't be made out of fear of termination. Both state and federal laws have tried to guarantee this, and I believe that SB 519 is a critical step toward ensuring that the freedom of conscience that lies at the cornerstone of American democracy extends to all personal decisions regarding political or religious activity. Thank you again for the opportunity to participate in the hearing today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you for your testimony. And members, are there any questions? Dr. Lafer, are you able to stay with us for questions, or how much time do you have?
If your questions to me could come in the next 10 minutes or so, that would be taking care of a two-year-old, so that would be good.
Okay, great. Members, are there questions for these witnesses? Okay. Yes. Go ahead, Senator George.
Thank you very much. Doctor, I guess here's my... I guess I find it very telling that the way you define this bill is a political bill, because the way I look at the relationship between an employer and an employee is, in essence, they are a partnership to try to keep a business in place so that the owner can make a profit and the employee can have a job. And so it seems like it's a pretty important, sacred relationship between those two. It's not a political situation. It's a sacred relationship where both of them are trying to keep their jobs and they're trying to keep the business, and they're trying to do it in the best way they possibly can to compete in the market. And so I guess when I look at this bill, and I think that we're going to, basically the state's going to intervene in the relationship between the employer and the employee in a manner to prohibit the employer from being able to share information about how certain how a third party, a union, would come in would affect the business is fundamentally undermining that relationship between the employer and the employee. And it has nothing to do, from my perspective, has nothing to do with politics other than that unions are very political. I view this as a completely different kind of relationship.
I would agree with the first part of your characterization that employees and employers are obviously in a partnership to keep businesses healthy. I don't think there's anybody who's more concerned with the financial health of a company than the people whose livelihoods depend on it. But there's a long tradition, again, starting from the founding fathers and certainly enshrined in both state and federal law, which makes a distinction between the work relationship and people's individual acts of political conscience. So, for instance, an employer cannot sit down and say, you're all going to be fired if I see you wearing a button for the wrong political party in federal elections. That's not, you know, there's more than one value. There's, of course, the value of cooperating to keep a company financially healthy. There is also the value of protecting American workers as citizens and being free to make political decisions, to make religious decisions, and to make decisions about union organizing. And my reading of this bill is it does not in any way prohibit or limit employers' freedom of speech. It only means that you can't be forced to listen to speech, which is really the way that all speech is treated in other areas of political, religious, or any other kind of associational life. But this is one of the only areas I know of where, at this point, someone can be forced to listen to partisan speech.
Madam Chair, if I could follow up.
Yes, follow up.
I would agree with you, other than let me give you another scenario. Let's say, for instance, I have employees that have engaged in sexual harassment of other employees. I can require them to come in and have this discussion about the impact on my business of one employee sexually harassing another employee, and I can force all my employees, and I should be able to force all my employees, because that has a direct impact not only on other employees but and the future of their employment, but also then the business's liability. And so it seems like to me that I should be able to, if I was an employer, should be able to communicate and require the attendance of employees in situations where it has a dramatic impact on the future of the business and in the employee-employee relationship. So I'm separating out sort of your political speech issue for a second and trying to focus in on the operation of the business, because I would say most business owners view their employees as their partners. And since they do, they have to look at the integrity, and they need partners to attend meetings, things like sexual harassment, things like OSHA regulations, things about workplace safety. In my industry, food safety requirements, all those things. And if somebody said, hey, you know what, I think I should be able to sexually harass anybody I want, I'm not going to attend the meeting, I think people would find that, so I'm finding it hard to where you're drawing the line, other than when you talk about political speech. And again, I view that as different.
Well, I think that the reason for being able to compel something like awareness training around sexual harassment or those kind of issues is not because does not stem from the fact that everybody has an economic interest in the livelihood of the business. It's because of the seriousness of sexual harassment and how statute treats that and a few similar issues. But essentially, you know, there is a value of the business being successful, but there are other values. So, for instance, the case of how we treat politics, and that is explicitly the analogy that the Congress and Senate and Labor Board embraces when they say what is supposed to be happening when people are making a decision about whether or not they want to have a union. But that is supposed to be an act of conscience analogous to the act when somebody decides who they're going to vote for in election to public office. And that in the same way that act should be made on the basis of, really, of what you said, on the basis of information that could come from anywhere, but it recognizes that information coming from one's employer, from one's direct supervisor, one's employer, is different than coming from somebody else. And, you know, there's all kinds of examples of that. I could say in my house, I don't want anybody from a certain political party coming into my house, but when I'm an employer, I can't say that because it carries a different kind of weight to it. And so the idea of, you know, what kind of situation is it supposed to be and conditions under which workers make a decision about whether or not they want to have a union is supposed to be a decision that is analogous to the same freedom of conscience that you have in choosing political parties, which is you're really deciding on the merits and you're not deciding out of fear. And the law in many other contexts recognizes what I think is obvious, which is employees are so sensitive to the words of their employers. I mean, most people, if their immediate supervisor says good morning in a gruff voice instead of good morning in a nice voice, that's enough to make them worry if they did something wrong or something's going to be coming at them. So when you have this much more heavy-handed, intensive grilling and intensive propaganda on one side of a political issue, it carries a weight of intimidation, which is unlike the same words coming out of anybody else's mouth, and which fundamentally corrupts that what is supposed to be a decision just based on the merits of the issues and not based on fear. So I don't know if that clarifies, but that's what I found in the research.
Thank you for your comments. Other questions for Dr. Layford before we let him go? Follow up?
Yeah, if I could.
Senator George, go ahead.
Doctor, I appreciate it. I guess I'm differentiating, but I want to ask you, I have a letter from the Attorney General of the State of Washington on a similar bill, and I'm waiting for a legislative council opinion on this particular bill, but the Attorney General of Washington on the bill that was in before the legislature viewed that the National Labor Relations Act preempted a similar bill, which is called Senate Bill 5446. I was wondering how you answer whether or not this violates the preemption that's in the National Labor Relations Act.
You know, my understanding is that it's not preempted because it does not limit employer speech. It only limits the compulsory nature of it. But I don't want to, I have certain expertise and credentials, and they don't extend to, competing with the Attorney General or a court about exactly what's preempted under federal law. So I don't want to pretend to more authority on that than I have.
And Senator George, I don't think the other members of the committee actually have copies of this letter unless it's attached to some testimony that we haven't received yet.
Yeah, I just got it.
Okay.
So maybe it'll
be introduced, but if you could share that with our committee administrator.
I actually sent this to legislative council and asked for an opinion from our legislative council if they agreed with this.
Well, Madam Chair, since this is now part of the record, I personally would like to have that plus whatever comes out of RLC.
Great.
I'll
So, Senator George, if you could share that letter with committee staff. I don't know if we have anybody in the room capable of making copies, but... Okay, well...
Can I ask one more question, Dr. Fourier leaves?
Sure, go ahead.
I want to get now into the area of political speech. And here is... Let me throw out a scenario that happened in the 1990s. A lot of family mills around the state... tried to express to their employees that certain political efforts were being made to limit the access to logs on federal forests. And they promised that basically if certain political things happen, that federal forests may be greatly limited, which would limit the number of logs coming through those family mills. Family mills were typically dependent on public lands, where larger corporate mills were dependent on private land that they owned. And they tried to express this. And some people complained about the political nature of that, saying it was false. But looking in hindsight, tens of thousands of Oregonians lost family wage jobs because employers really felt intimidated about expressing what would really happen if we lost access to the federal forest. That's come true. And it seems like to me that an employee who has a family wage job has a right to know certain political activities going on that would take their job from a $25 an hour job and put them out of a job, and now we're training them for $9 an hour jobs in tourism. And I guess my point is, in that situation, that'd be political speech, but the employee has an absolute right to hear about political actions that are happening that would take away their job. And clearly, that is an example where tens of thousands of Oregonians lost their job because of the access to the forest. And I would say it would be remiss of a employer not to express those kind of political speech to an employee, because it has a direct financial impact on that employee. And we had, like I said, tens of thousands of family wage jobs lost because of those activities. And I'm trying to figure out how you differentiate that.
Let me say two things. I mean, first of all, the way federal electoral law works is that workers can get that information from any place except from their own employer. I'm sorry, can you still hear me?
Yeah.
Yes, and if you could please re-identify yourself for the record, that would be great.
Yes, this is Professor Gordon Lafer from the University of Oregon Labor Education and Research Center. The Chamber of Commerce, the Timber Employers Association, anyone like that, and other employees themselves are free to distribute that information. What federal law is very, very careful to distinguish is speech coming from one's direct employer. It is in a completely different category. So it's not a question of can or should people get information like that. It's a question of recognizing the difference between the sources. So that's one point. The second point is the case that you suggest, at least the facts as you presented them, as I understand it, is kind of very clear cut. Here you are. There's a real danger of losing your job. In the decision to form a union, you hear that language a lot, and it is always false. It's for this reason. Creating a union per se imposes no cost whatsoever on an employer. The place where costs may or may not be imposed is when you get to negotiating a contract. And there is no ban whatsoever on an employer saying to employees, this thing you're asking for about wages or whatever the economic benefits are, those are unaffordable, or they're going to make us uncompetitive, or they're going to drive us out of business over the long term. Any of those things that you're talking about, that's the place where it comes in. But an actual decision of workers about whether or not to create a union imposes no cost on the employer. And therefore, all of the speeches that when somebody says, oh, if an employer says, oh, by unionizing you're going to drive us out of business, is explicitly false, because all unionizing is a decision to negotiate. It doesn't require the employer to agree to anything. It doesn't have anything to do with any demands being made. And so the way I would see it is the conversation that you're talking about is an important conversation. There is a provision under federal labor law where if employers can't afford what a union is asking for, what employees are asking for, they can open their books, show that they can't afford it. There's not a single known case of a union being shown that an employer can't afford something. And that happens fairly often in recession times like this, and going ahead anyway, trying to force it. So there is provision for that. There's absolutely provision and recognition of what I understand you to be talking about, which is the importance of an employer sharing that information. But it comes at the point of negotiations rather than in the decision to form a union, because at that point, it's not factually true, and it functions as intimidating speech that chills what should just be a political decision on its merits.
Madam Chair. Yes, Senator Pruzanski.
Thank you. Now, Senator George, you've had 15 minutes now. I think some of us might want to make sure the professor can answer some other questions.
Oh, I'm sorry. So,
Professor, let me ask you this. Based on the scenario that Senator George just gave us, there's nothing to stop that employee. If that employee chose to listen to that speech, to actually hear that speech, is there?
That's right, even with SB 519 passed.
So basically, it's really giving the choice to the employee whether they want to hear that form, that speech in that form from that individual, or if they want to go seek that information from someone else. This bill would not stop them from doing that, would it?
Yes, so that's exactly right, and I think that I may not have made that clear enough. An employer could advertise, hey, I have information that I think is critical to your future livelihoods, and I'm going to invite you all to come at whatever time and place, and everybody could choose to come, and I assume many of them would.
Okay, thank you. And Senator George, we have 12 more people signed up to testify on this bill, and we won't be able to hear from half of them if we don't move on.
One follow-up question.
Yes, a final question.
Yeah. I guess what I'm trying to get at is when I read Section 2, Subsection A, it says that this bill would cover the type of speech that I'm talking about. And do you get that as far as political speech? Is that your interpretation?
Would cover in a meeting like that could not be mandatory where
correct.
A company is telling somebody vote for this party or vote for that party?
Like if I had a small family mill and I said I want to have an employee meeting on employee time and this is what the impact of this would be, I could not require my employee to come and hear a presentation about what something would do to cut off federal logs coming to our mill.
My understanding of this is that there couldn't be a mandatory meeting telling people which way to vote. That there could be a voluntary meeting saying that, and there could be a mandatory meeting saying other things, but not telling people which way they should vote.
Okay, thank you, and thank you for your testimony. We do have quite a few other people signed up to testify, so thank you, Dr. Lafer, for being with us today.
And if you
want to stay on the phone and listen, you're welcome to do that, but if you need to drop off, please go ahead and do that.
Thanks very much.
And, Barbara, I think we will be alternating back and forth between supporters and opponents, so if you want to stay here, and if there are questions at the
absolutely.
End and we have time, we'll call you back up.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. So we will try to alternate back and forth, and I think next I will call J.L. Wilson and Paul Ostroff. You'd like to come forward. And members, in the meantime, we did actually get some of our capable floor staff to go make copies of the Attorney General letter from Washington, so you should have that in front of you as well. Good afternoon. Welcome to the Commerce Committee.
Hi, thank you. Actually, as part of my testimony, Chair, the AG's opinion is...
Attached?
Attached.
Well, we have it now, so... Please go ahead, whichever
yes,
of you wishes to go
Chair
first.
Rosenbaum and members, for the record, J.L. Wilson, representing Associated Oregon Industries. With me is Paul Ostroff, counsel with Elaine Powell, who will do the heavy lifting on this issue, but I have initial brief comments. AOI is opposed to Senate Bill 519, really questioning... Are we doing this as an issue of fairness? I think it's important to know that captive audience speech is in fact protected by the National Labor Relations Act in the same way that it protects union communication rights, whether that is obtaining names and addresses of workers, being able to visit them at their homes, precluding employers from contacting employees 24 hours prior to an election. The NLRA law today establishes balance and rights for both parties. What 519 does essentially is create an unfair labor practice through state law in an area that's already governed by federal law for which federal remedy exists. Now, it leads me to the bigger point of the issue of preemption. Is in fact 519 or areas of state law that address this subject matter, in fact, are they preempted by federal law? And I think the answer overwhelmingly is yes. 519, in our opinion, amounts to a constitutionally questionable state supervision over federal law. It provides for state law claims and subject matter that is governed by federal law. It provides remedies that are far in excess of remedies that are prescribed by federal law. And as you see attached to my testimony, the AG's opinion in the state of Washington on legislation that is similar to 519 that's being considered right now. The same logic of this brief dictates the terms of this debate, which is to say constitutional case law clearly comes down on this separation of responsibilities, if you will. The Garmin decision alluded to from 1959, the 2008 decision, last year's decision in Brown versus, or U.S. Chamber of Commerce versus Brown, clearly draw a wall of separation between the two, which is to say what is the purview of the NLRB belongs to the federal government, and that is not for the state to intrude on that area of law. So I'm going to let Mr. Ostroff continue on that line of thought, but I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Yes, Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee. My name is Paul Ostroff. I'm a shareholder at Lane Powell. I specialize in the field of labor and employment law. I've been doing that for 33 years. I represent employers predominantly. In an earlier stage of my career, I represented unions. I pride myself on advising our clients to comply with their legal obligations, and am proud to say that I don't believe I've ever done anything which would threaten organized labor institutionally. But I'm here today to comment on why we believe this bill is bad public policy and raises very serious legal questions which may have ramifications both for the business community as well as for the state. The statute provides for back pay, injunctive relief, attorney's fees, treble damages for a variety of communications that employers may customarily make. It extends to communications which I think would be very surprising for most employers to learn. They could be precluded, at the risk at least, of major damage liability from making to their employees. Let me give you an illustration. Many employers want to apprise their employees of the benefits that they receive. It's not uncommon for employers to apprise employees of the benefits that employers in their industry provide to them as well. Now, they may do so for reasons of suggesting to their employees that their benefit package is competitive with other companies in their industry, other companies of which might be unionized. This bill would preclude that because it precludes the employer from making any communication, effectively precludes the employer at risk of serious damage liability for making communications, as well as causing an employee to participate in a communication. It doesn't just extend to meetings, it extends to participation in communications. In other words, if a supervisor had a dialogue with an employee that might intrude into one of these areas, then that communication, that single one-on-one communication, may also clearly by its terms, would violate the law. What are some other common communications that employers make to employees? Employers commonly convey to employees that they have an open-door policy, that they believe it is in their employees' best interest that there not be an intermediary, that they be able to deal directly with their management regarding workplace issues. This is a very content, the bill on its face, because of its preclusion of, quote, employer-sponsored communications that would have a bearing on this very standard workplace practice, could expose an employer to damage liability merely because they made that communication and the employee asked not to be a party to that communication. Now, the bill's remedies, which are, I dare say, draconian, they go well beyond the normal damage remedies. They open up the door to punitive damages and emotional distress damages, thereby creating substantial risks for employers in making a wide variety of communications to their employees that may relate to union or political matters. Now, we've heard quite a bit about the role of the National Labor Relations Board. This bill is, in my estimation, preempted by the National Labor Relations Act. First of all, under the Garmin Doctrine, which provides that states may not validly legislate in areas covering conduct that may arguably be an unfair labor practice. Employees have a right to resort to the processes of the National Labor Relations Board. To give you an illustration, if an employee expressed their views contrary to the employer's expressed views and for that reason was subjected to adverse action, that employee can file a charge with the NLRB. The NLRB conducts an investigation. It may issue a complaint, prosecute the action on behalf of the employee or the labor organization, and obtain for that employee reinstatement, back pay, and other remedies. So it is, we submit, not accurate to suggest that employees are left without a remedy if it is claimed that there has been adverse action because of their expression of dissatisfaction or their expression of opposition or even their silent expression of opposition. Most private sector employers in the state of Oregon are covered by the National Labor Relations Act. And I think it's important to note that employers under the Act have free speech rights by statute. It states that Section 8C of the National Labor Relations Act states that the expression of any views, argument, or opinion, or the dissemination thereof, whether in written, printed, graphic, or visual form, shall not constitute or be evidence of an unfair labor practice under any of the provisions of this subchapter, i.e. the NLRA. If such expressions contain no threat of reprisal or promise of benefit. Again, federal law prohibits an employer from communicating to employees in a way that is coercive or which promises benefits. Example, perhaps an across-the-board wage increase might be forthcoming if employees decide to abandon a union organizing campaign. That's just as illegal as a threat of adverse action. So the NLRB has occupied this field, and the federal government has designated it as the responsible agency for regulating in this area. Now, we've heard some discussion about, and I would refer to Professor Laffer's comments, that somehow or another communications are not available to unions. I think that that is a very narrow view of what those rights consist of. First of all, employees on the work site are permitted to discuss union matters in non-work areas during non-working hours. In other words, during breaks, lunchtime. Unions are entitled to make home visits. That's something which employers are prohibited from doing. They can't make home visits. Unions are entitled and have a statutory right to conduct meetings off premises at their in their discretion.
Excuse me, Mr. Ostroff.
Certainly.
It looks like you're reading from something which we don't have in front of us, but I'm going to ask you to summarize your testimony and then maybe provide your written testimony,
yes,
because we do have quite a few people and I want to leave time for questions.
Thank you very much. Okay. Because these communications are so comprehensively regulated by the National Labor Relations Board, we believe that it is very clear that this law is preempted both under the Garmin Doctrine as well as under the Supreme Court's recent decision in Brown. I recognize that there are some differences between this bill and the legislation that was at issue in Brown, but nonetheless, the bill allows the government to place its finger on the scale in ways that intrude upon the free exchange that federal law requires and federal law regulates. One other point, we believe the law is likely to be held unconstitutional as well as preempted. Employers have a right to communicate their views concerning unions, and that's been held protected by the Constitution as well as by federal law. Last, I think it is noteworthy that there is going, if a bill of this nature is enacted, it's very likely that there will be litigation, either by declaratory relief action or in individual actions, which will inevitably embroil the state in a dispute over its legality, because the Attorney General must be notified if the constitutionality or legality or validity of a statute is placed in issue. One final comment. Many of the concerns that have been voiced by organized labor, and I greatly respect the comments made by the representative from the AFL-CIO, many of those concerns we submit are going to be addressed by Congress when it takes up the Employee Free Choice Act. Now, whether that bill will be enacted is still uncertain. Just this week, President Obama advised the leaders of organized labor that he was fully behind the bill and expected it to be enacted. I'm simply suggesting that it may be premature for action to be considered on this bill, if only for that purely practical reason. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. And if you could provide your written testimony to our staff so that we can distribute it, we would appreciate
it. I will, sir.
And any brief questions for these witnesses? Okay, thank you very much. So next we'll call, and I'm going to ask witnesses from now on to limit the comments to about 3 minutes or less so that we can try to get through everybody we have signed up to testify. Next we'll call Jeffrey Terrell and Charlie Finger and Georgine Berrigan. And then after they've testified, we will call a panel of Barry Bashu, Sean Cleave, and Tim Bernasik. So if the three of you could also be ready to pop up here, we'll be able to move quickly. Welcome to our committee, and I think you... some of your written comments might have already been provided, so if you could please start by telling us who you are, and then don't read word for word your testimony if we have it in writing, but just tell us your story. Please go ahead.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, my name is Jeffrey Terrell. For the last 10 years, I've been employed by Oak Harbor Freight Lines. My job is on the dock, driving forklift, loading and unloading trailers, working in distribution, and filling out paperwork. In 2008, my coworkers and I were subject to mandatory meetings at least 2 to 3 weeks, 2 to 3 every couple weeks. Why do I call these meetings mandatory, and why would we want to attend? The mandatory meetings were supposedly held to update us on progress of the contract negotiations between management at Oak Harbor Freight Lines and our union Teamsters, Local 81. After we had these meetings, we also had to stay and watch their company DVDs that were also sent to our homes a week or so before the meetings in hopes that we'd watch them at our home on our own time. These DVDs were on subjects around the owner's views of changing our health care, taking away our sick leave, and taking away 101 provisions from our existing contract. These meetings were held by our operations manager. At one point, I asked my supervisor if I had to be present at a meeting, and I was directly told that it was mandatory. I asked if I could sit out and instead go back to work before I even went into the meeting, since it was the busiest day of the week and a peak hour of business. I was told I had to attend. At one point in our Auburn terminal, a female dock worker said she wanted out of a meeting and got up to leave. The terminal manager physically grabbed her by her arm and put her back in her chair. When I mentioned this to one of our supervisors, he stated that if anyone got up to leave a meeting, he would accept that as their resignation. Yesterday, on my third day back after 5 months of being on strike, our operations manager held a meeting to inform us that 8 of our terminals would be voting to decertify. These meetings just created divisions at our workplace. They stopped us from getting our work done and made us feel disrespected and intimidated. Should people be physically forced to sit through a lecture on subjects like our personal beliefs and our opinions? I thank you for considering changing the law so that other Oregonians don't have to sit through the ordeals I've had to. Sincerely, Jeff Terrell, 10-year Oak Harbor Freight Lines employee, Local 81 Teamster.
Thank you for your testimony. I think we'll hold questions till each of you has had a chance to testify. So please go ahead.
That would be me. Good afternoon, Chair Rosenbaum and members of the committee. My name is Charles Fenger, and I am here in support of Senate Bill 519. One of the disagreeable tactics employed by McCall Oil and Chemical of Portland to intimidate us from becoming members of the Inland Boatmen's Union of the Pacific was the mandatory meeting. Not long after serving the company with notice of our demand to be recognized as a union via hand-delivered letter and union pledge cards signed by 100% of the crew, the company issued a date and time for when each employee would be required to appear. The only purpose of this meeting was for the president and CEO to inform us of the owning family's displeasure at our effort to organize. The company's stated position was that we, the employees, were allowing a third party to interject themselves into the company's business. This would only serve to make matters worse. The union would impede the company's ability to run its business, give us raises and benefits, as well as reward deserving employees. In fact, a negotiated contract could get us less than we had now. We would also be wasting our money by giving it to the union in the form of dues. At no time was there any acknowledgement of the issues that drove us to unionize, nor interest in addressing them. I'd like to point out that McCall Oil Chemical operates a large, dangerous, and complex facility 24/7, 365 days a year. The terminal manager expended large amounts of time and energy in an effort to keep overtime to a minimum. This, of course, led to erratic hours and days worked for the small crew. Not only did this meeting disrupt much-needed time off, but it cost the company money and additional wages. What made the tactics so striking was that prior to organizing, the crew were treated as red-headed foster kids. There was no contact with the owning family. The only contact we had from the president were edicts issued by the terminal manager in his name. This mandatory meeting was a clear and blatant attempt to intimidate us and not to organize. So I would respectfully urge this body to pass Senate Bill 519 so that no other workers in the state of Oregon will have to suffer this abuse of power. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. And please go ahead.
Chair Rosenbaum and members of the Senate committee, my name is Georgine Berrigan. I am a bakery, confectionery, tobacco, and grain miller union member. I am currently working at Red Song IBR Bakery. Been there for almost 2 years now in the process of an organizing campaign. And during this campaign drive, I was required to attend four mandatory meetings and had to listen to the anti-union videos, the threats of benefits being taken away, such as the company's 401k contribution, the employee stock option, the ESOP, lies about union forcing workers to go on strike, that it's not their choice. The union says strike, you have to strike. Lectures about mandatory union dues and dues check off, that it would happen immediately after a yes vote, and that all the union was there for was for their money, for the workers' money. Threats of a possible plant closure. Again, IBR Bread Song Bakery is owned by Cargill, and there was talk that they could move it to any other plant anywhere else and have the production done there. Statements that it would take 12 months longer to negotiate a contract, and that their hands would be tied and there would be no raises until there was a negotiated contract in effect. And then also we were all subjected to an employee engagement survey. In these mandatory meetings, I witnessed my coworkers afraid to speak or ask any questions, that they would be singled out. And those of us who did speak and ask questions were shut down quickly and treated as if we didn't have the knowledge that, you know, of what was really going on. Also witnessed a Hispanic worker, pro-union Hispanic worker, who was forced to translate to another Hispanic worker the company's anti-union voice. I was also made to attend two-on-one meetings with the plant manager and the HR managers, where I was questioned about the improvements I felt that the company could make to keep me from voting yes for the union. I know that other workers were subjected to the same meetings as well. We were not given a choice whether or not to attend these meetings. In the case of the survey, two-on-one meetings with the workers who were off on vacation and disability leave, they were called and told to come in. They would be paid for their time. They were called off vacation, and one gentleman who had just been injured and had surgery on his shoulder, the rotator cuff, they were forced to come in and take this survey, because the company wanted 100% compliance. These meetings cut into the work time, they cut into the vacation times, and also they intimidated the workers so that they would support the company's opinion. If you have any other questions or need any further information, please don't hesitate to call me. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Any brief questions for this panel?
Sure.
Senator George? One brief question, because we do have a lot of other people.
I appreciate all three of you coming. I want to ask you kind of a question. I don't know if you heard my earlier question about the sawmill workers and the federal policy that was coming down that would shut off logs to family mills and family wage jobs were lost. In your own business, can you think of a political speech that an employer could bring to you of an issue affecting the business that would affect your employment that you would think would be appropriate to require a mandatory meeting? Meaning, if there was something that was really threatening the business, that was something going on at the federal level, at the state level, that could actually put the business out of business and you all could lose jobs, is there any time that you think it would be appropriate for an employer to say, I have a mandatory meeting, I really need to talk to you about this political issue? I mean, it's outside the union stuff. I'm talking about broader political issue, like the supply of logs to the mills.
I'm not sure what your question is there. My understanding and in my experience with mandatory meetings, does the company have a right to impose their opinion on us to try to change our minds? No. That's how I feel.
Can I clarify the question, Madam Chair?
No, actually, we do need to move on because we're going to run out of time before we've heard from a balanced presentation. So thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Next to the Farm Bureau, please come forward Tim Bernasek, Sean Cleave, and Barry Bashu. And then please be ready after this panel, Bill Gresh, I'm not sure I'm saying your name correctly, and Melissa Unger. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sean Cleave, representing the Oregon Farm Bureau. I don't want to belabor the testimony today. We've already heard quite a bit that would probably be redundant from my voice at this point. I am submitting some written testimony. Now, we do have Tim Bernasek, legal counsel with us for the Farm Bureau, and also Barry Bashu, president of the Oregon Farm Bureau and vice president of American Farm Bureau. And I just invite them to speak on specific issues that we have teased up in our written testimony.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity. You may be asking yourself,
could you please tell us you are?
Barry Bashu. I'm president of the Oregon Farm Bureau and farm up near Gresham, Oregon. You may be asking yourselves, why are farmers here? We are employers as well, and I think what I'd like to do is make a little bit of differential between some of the folks that have spoken about some of the large companies that they work for and bring more reference to the workplace that I have on my farm individually. Our workplace at home is really nothing more than just a microcosm of society. We have lots of different kinds of people with lots of different political views. We talk about the news. We talk about religion. We talk about the issues that are on the TV. We talk about the issues in the paper. And frankly, all employees and myself as an employer are in fact compelled to be in that workplace because it is a requirement of employment and it is a requirement for my business to continue. So we work hand-in-hand with the folks who work for us. We spend 8 hours a day in a greenhouse planting. We're out in the field harvesting. We're shearing. We're in trucks delivering. We're at the farmers market selling our product. And we are in constant contact with our employees day after day after day. The requirements for work change because of the weather. They change because of the cultural practices, depending upon the types of plants we're working on. They change because of whatever orders we're placing, whatever farmers' markets may be open, and those things change on a daily basis. Now, since we are part of a family, in effect, I mean, some of the folks have worked for us for 26 years. We attend each other's weddings, we attend each other's christenings, we attend each other's funerals, we do all these things together, and it's almost impossible to preclude discussions of almost anything that you folks discuss with your neighbors and your friends in our workplace. You say to yourself, well, this bill doesn't preclude that. And in fact, what happens, it puts me as an employer at risk of discussing these things. Many times, direct questions to me as an employer sitting around a greenhouse table planting plants, somebody will say, hey, I see the Employee Free Choice Act, or perhaps one that generated the most discussion was a potential for a comprehensive immigration reform package. There was a lot of discussion of that on my farm. There's discussion about unions. There's discussion about who should be president, discussions about who should represent Gresham as a senator. There's discussions about all these types of things in my workplace. And, what happens if I start changing those work practices, if today we're doing strawberries and tomorrow we decide to go dig trees, if there's someone new working at my place and we may have these political discussions the day before, it could be represented as some kind of a disciplinary action that they can't pick strawberries today, they have to dig trees tomorrow. It puts me at risk of constantly having to defend familial type discussions that we have at our workplace. I think that's unreasonable. I think it's unfair. And when I look at the overall ramifications of this bill, it appears to be an opportunity to allow employees to have freedom of speech, but to take that away from the employers in having frank discussions about the workplace. I think I would ask you to consider, each of you hire staff of some type or another. I would ask you to consider what the ramifications are to you to pulling your staff together and saying, our position on this bill is going to be this, and I expect you to sell it. I also ask you to consider the ramifications of political life every day. There are people that have deductions from their salaries mandated, and much of that salary may be spent on political purposes for benefit to a particular issue. I would be precluded from doing that, nor do I want to do that. I don't want to get involved in people's political lives, but it's a reality that we have these discussions regularly, and I don't want to be put at risk of doing that. I also think you ought to consider, I think Mr. Bernassi is going to talk a little bit about the potential constitutionality of this. Our economy is only going to be rebuilt on the backs of small businesses and large businesses alike, in collaboration with employees and employers. Does this state really want to risk a piece of legislation and the potential cost of that potential legislation if it is going to be determined somehow unconstitutional? I would ask you your forbearance on that. So with that, unless you have any questions, I just ask you to be considerate of this and look to the fact that as a small businessman, I rely on my employees. They rely on me. I think it would be unreasonable to assume that we can no longer have the type of frank and familial discussions we've been having for the last 26 years. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Please go ahead.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, for the record, Tim Bernasek, a legal counsel with the Oregon Farm Bureau. I'm also a practicing attorney with the law firm of Dunn Carney in Portland and practice in their labor and employment section, and have represented a lot of employers in employment actions. And I want to very briefly, or as briefly as I can, hit on two issues. Number one is the practical ramifications for employers in litigation scenarios this bill opens up, and briefly hit on some of the constitutional issues that Mr. Bichu talked about. I know you've heard a lot about that from previous speaker, so I won't belabor that point. But one of the real concerns I have about this bill is it touches on the issues that Barry raised about communications in the workplace. And these always, in the legal context, they come up, you know, after some event has occurred in the workplace. Often it's a discharge or some adverse employment action. The question is, why was that adverse employment action taken? And this opens up a whole can of worms as far as advising employers how to communicate and deal with their employees to avoid litigation risk. Again, oftentimes in employment litigation, it's not whether you prevail at the end of the day, because very few of these cases end up going all the way through to court, but it's how do you handle and manage the litigation costs in a lot of these efforts. And this is going to be a huge burden for employers to bear in trying to determine what speech is appropriate and what speech is not appropriate to have with their employees in the workforce, and when would they be open to potential treble damages, reinstatement, back pay. These are very serious penalties, and would be very problematic in many, many lawsuits in that regard. I could go on that, but I'll quickly shift gears, because I know time is limited, to talk about the constitutionality of this bill. And I think that you have the AG's opinion from the state of Washington. I also want to talk a little bit about the Supreme Court case that AG's opinion is based on. It just came out this last summer, which is the Chamber versus Brown decision. It was a 7-2 decision that was written by Justice Stevens, not one of the most conservative members of the court. And he talks about the policy that you heard from previous speakers in the National Labor Relations Act that makes it clear the National Labor Relations Act preempts the field in this area of regulating speech regarding to union organizing. I want to just really quickly talk about Justice Stevens talking about the policy behind Section 8C of the National Labor Relations Act, which talks about the need for open and free, fair discussion amongst unions and employers in the workplace in the election context. He says, we've characterized this policy judgment, which suffuses the NLRA as a whole, as favoring uninhibited, robust, and wide-open debate in labor disputes, stressing that the freewheeling use of the written and spoken word has been expressly fostered by Congress and approved by the National Labor Relations Board. So this free-flowing discussions, and again, talk about the tools, the economic tools that the unions have, visiting homes and their opportunities to communicate with employees. One of the tools that employers have is to call mandatory meetings, again, not within a 24-hour period of time before the election. That's one sideboard that has been put in place. That's prohibited. But the policy behind the National Labor Relations Act, the carefully crafted balance, is to make sure that employers have an opportunity to disseminate information to the employees. Interestingly, there is a dissent in this opinion, and it's by Justice Breyer. But his dissent talks about not in terms of the content of the communication, but the fact that in California, what was at issue was that public funds couldn't be used by employers to communicate about unionization. And that's what Justice Breyer was concerned about. And he said that this would be a different matter, because we all recognize that if it's on the employer's dime, it's their right to communicate. And that's exactly what this bill is infringing upon. So it's very clear to me that if this bill is passed, it will be challenged. It will go through the courts. I believe if it has to go all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, it will lose based on, it will be struck down, at least that provision, under the Chamber versus Brown decision. And the cost to the state I would just ask you to consider the cost in litigating that through the whole process. So with that, I know time is limited. I'd be more than happy to address any questions or comments that you would have.
Yes, Senator Manus Anderson.
Just briefly, and welcome, Barry, from my area. In reading of the bill, in Section 2, lines 24-25, I want to know how we can make this bill better then. And it's referring to an employer-sponsored meeting, which is what I was most concerned with, and that is why I signed on the meeting onto the bill. Excuse me. But it's the second part of that, or communication. And if or communication, thank you, Larry. was eliminated, would that make it better?
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Manus Anderson, I think that would be a step in the right direction, but I still think the constitutional flaw in the bill remains as it regards to employer speech. The issue in the chamber case was mandated employer meetings or employer communications, which mandatory meetings are a part of. And so I think that if you take that piece out, I think it certainly helps, but I still think the constitutional flaw is still present in the bill. The state is attempting to regulate what is gamut or the policy of Congress, and it's federally preempted, so I still think you have that problem.
I still have an issue with forcing an employee in a brainwashing type activity is how I'm looking at it, and that's different than I think some of the examples that you've been bringing up. Because I would agree with Mr. Bashu that it'd be very difficult. You don't want to infringe on just regular type communication. So, in order to narrow this, is where I'm trying to go. And I'm not an attorney, so I'm just wondering how we could make this bill where the intent was to not be forcing someone to attend, I call it a brainwashing type activity.
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Manus Anderson, I guess a couple comments. One, just sort of a process-wise or kind of common sense or real world, I was taken by the panel that was just up here that talked about the impact that they took from these mandatory meetings that they were subjected to. And I guess if I were an attorney representing the employers that that they dealt with, it seems to me their mandatory employer meeting backfired. If they were exerting the kind of pressure and influence that was alleged by the members representing, it had the exact opposite effect that I would think those employers, if the goal was to avoid unionization that they intended. I would assume from their testimony that they were obviously upset and concerned about what happened, and so they probably, when they had the opportunity to vote, they voted the other way. So I guess that's just one comment, is that employers, even though they're legally authorized to have these meetings, I think need to be careful how they conduct themselves for fear of having the exact opposite effect that they intend. The other matter I would say is I don't know how pervasive, I mean, I understand how the bill is written, and we've talked about the constitutional problems with that. I don't know, as a practical matter, the employers that I certainly have represented, how often these types of meetings and the type of coercive brainwashing activity that is alleged that could potentially occur actually does occur. Politics, religion, things of that nature. I'm just not aware of that happening very often. Again, that may be my own experience. But I guess I just, from my standpoint, and maybe Mr. Bashu or Mr. Cleave have other comments, but I don't know, I understand what you're trying to get at, but I don't think we can get there from here based on the Supreme Court precedent that's put in place as the bill affects union organizing type activity.
So, and I actually had a question for you, too. I'll let you respond, but you might want to respond to this one, too. So I don't necessarily agree with this preemption argument, and we'll have to look at what legislative counsel and the Washington law said. But specifically, my question is, because the National Labor Relations Act does not cover agriculture, and we all the time in this building have been discussing and debating proposed legislation dealing with labor law in agriculture because that's something that's left to the states to regulate, I guess I don't really get the argument that even if there were a preemption problem in areas that were covered by the National Labor Relations Act, why would that apply in agriculture?
Chair Rosenbaum, you're absolutely right. The National Labor Relations Act does not apply to agriculture, but it doesn't mean that unionization does not occur. And I've been involved in many, many of the issues and fights on various farms in this state in the last 10 years. So we've had a lot of battle scars over getting used to and understanding how organizing would occur. I think that what would end up happening is that, you know, I'm just talking about the nature of the bill, that I think National Labor Relations would preempt it for most employers. But again, I think that what you're addressing speaks to the larger concern that we've had in agriculture for many, many years, that we're not regulated by some sort of collective bargaining law, that we're hanging out here. And I think that the concerns that the issue that you raise is absolutely correct. There is a chance that if this bill were preempted for most employers, agriculture once again is left hanging out there with questions as to how we communicate with our employees. So it's a big concern, a bigger concern about the bill, and a particular concern for agricultural employers, because we don't know how it would play out for us.
Thank you. And did you have a comment?
Well, if I could, Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Montes Anderson, a couple of quick things. I'm not in a position to help you write a bill which philosophically I have some issues with. I'm not used to the concept of an antagonistic workplace. I took high school for 15 years and didn't find that an antagonistic place. And on my farm, I don't find the relationship between myself and my employees antagonistic. And so the concept of muting one or the other sides of a very clear, important, almost symbiotic relationship is foreign to me. The issue that with this language, no matter how you clean it up, there's still somebody has to determine somewhere, and as an employee, I will have to defend whether or not working in a greenhouse is an employer-sponsored meeting or a communication, no matter how you characterize it here. No matter how you call it in these rules, somebody, I'm going to have to defend my actions at my expense. And with regard to the preemption, I'm no expert, and Tim gave you an excellent answer there, but part of the problem is we work within an agricultural infrastructure of which not everybody we deal with is a farmer, and therefore they're not exempt.
And as a farmer, if I have a retail stand and we are packaging products from somebody else, then sometimes my workers do come under. Mine don't, but various farms' workers do come under various formats of the National Labor Relations Act. And they are difficult to separate. You're the same employees doing two different kinds of work on the same farm. And so you're still come up against the language itself, which always has to be interpreted by a court someplace. And I know all the bills you'll deal with are that way. But for what it's worth, I just think that philosophically, my organization and me personally find it difficult to be put in a position not to have open. Some of you know me better than others. I'm a very open, frank person. And I expect my employees to be, I expect to be, and to put a wall between us, I think, is particularly egregious and does nothing to impact positively our basic economy. So,
Senator Przanski.
Yeah, and Mr. Beshear, I just want to give you my perspective on what you've testified to and how your farm works. I didn't hear anything in there that would be actionable, because some of the examples you said, what if one of your workers actually brought up the subject to you? You're responding to them. I mean, possibly Tim would say, as an employer, you need to make certain that they want to participate in that conversation. But there's nothing from you being able to have those frank discussions across the board. You know, whether it's religion at the workplace or political or whatever it is, it sounds like you have a very open process. What you're not doing is what I see in this bill. You're sponsoring, forcing someone to be in a place and not allowing them to say, no, I don't want to do this. No, I can't. No, you can't leave. You have to listen to what I want to tell you. But instead, it's the interchange that's voluntary between you and your employees. Tim, am I wrong on that?
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Przanski, no, you're absolutely correct in a sense. And my experience with these employment cases is everything's fine as long as they're an employee. But sometimes perceptions of these meetings change after they're no longer, for whatever reason, whether it's for good or bad, they've been discharged or demoted, or some concern gets raised, and so it ends up showing up in a lawsuit that, well, wait a minute, you know, actually, I didn't feel very comfortable, and that was either concern I would have is, well, I was required to be in that, Barry's example, the nursery shed, so I was compelled to work. We were talking about politics or whatever it may be, and maybe at some point I say, you know, I'm not comfortable with this, but we continued to talk about it. It ends up showing up in litigation later that we have to get into who said what, and again,
right.
Oftentimes these things, this isn't the only bill, or this isn't the only law that's an issue, but it's one more that I think, particularly with the vagueness of some of these standards, it creates problems and is a problem. As I look at this in trying to work with the clients that I represent to be proactive in employment practices to avoid litigation risk, even if you've done everything right, doesn't mean you don't have litigation risk. So the game we're always trying to do is minimizing that risk. This creates some unanswered questions that are very problematic.
And that's right, Tim, but there's nothing that would stop a person that wanted to file a lawsuit for whatever reason or a grievance with NLRB or whoever from doing that. And it's only based on a factual basis as to whether or not it was brought with merit. And if it was not brought in merit, there may be sanctions because of that.
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Przanski, you're absolutely right. But this now adds treble damages, reinstatement back pay, additional penalties that we navigate through. So it is clearly a problem for employers.
And I think that will have to be the last word for now, because we do have still several other people who want to
Chair Rosenbaum,
if we have time
to
left,
provide
we'll
copies of the Supreme Court decision to the committee as well.
Yeah, Brown. And
Mr. Beshear, did you have a short comment? I don't want to leave you hanging.
My only comment, Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Przanski, my only comment would be this litigation puts me in even yet another position as an employer of having to defend the workplace. And I just can't understand why we would want to do that to another small business.
I understand.
Thank you
for your testimony. Next, we'll call Bill Gretz. I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly, and Melissa Unger. And then please be ready. Next panel, Dave Fiskum, Andy Easton, and Jenna Kaluza. Good afternoon. Thanks for being so patient. Whichever of you has decided to go first, please go ahead.
Okay. Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, my name is Bill Gross. I live close to Bend, and I'm a constituent of Senator Telford. And when she served on the city council in Bend, they had a bell that you can ring in 3 minutes, and you feel free to do so if you like with me. I was a driver for Paratransit Services, and they were and still are the contractor providing dial-a-ride and public transit services to the city of Bend. After spending 2 years helping to organize a union and successfully obtaining a 3-year contract, I left last July because of all the stress involved in that fight, and I'm currently unemployed. I will spare you, mercifully, all the details about organizing, but as soon as word got out to management of Paratransit, mandatory meetings were announced. Employees were paid for their time and met with the company president one-on-one, sometimes in groups of up to 4, for several meetings. From the very beginning, however, myself and 3 others were excluded. Depending on how you reacted at a meeting or the kind of questions you asked, further exclusions followed until the number of employees shut out of meetings totaled 8. This caused a lot of friction, especially since the workforce only numbered 38 to begin with. Some employees did not want to attend a meeting. Some felt bad that some of us were not invited to these paid meetings. Still others felt the excluded ones caused this whole mess and should be fired. Altogether, I witnessed company-mandated meetings adding stress and anxiety to an already volatile situation. It would have made a big difference, eased a lot of minds, and avoided some uncomfortable scenarios if all of us, those who were forced to attend and those who were forced not to, would have had the choice available of whether to attend these meetings or not. Being an immigrant to this country, I find it ironic that we currently do not have the freedom to do just that. Back in 66, I was drafted. That's about as mandatory as you can get. Since I was not a citizen at the time, I was given the choice to serve as a registered alien or to go back to my native country with no chance to return here. But at least I was given a choice. I believe in our freedom, so I chose to serve. And as a naturalized citizen and a veteran, I ask that you extend the freedom that's introduced in this proposed bill to all of our workers here in Oregon. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, my name is Melissa Unger, and I'm with SEIU Local 503. And I don't think I have that much to add. I think the workers have said it best, but I do want to be on the record in support of this bill. And I think that the points that were brought up by Senator Przanski are well taken. I really do think that the point of this is that if an employee and an employer are having a conversation where both people feel respected in the conversation, and that it's actually a conversation, conversations will continue to exist in the workplace. And I think that this is a situation where I think one of the workers referred to it is when they're being told what to believe and told what to do, that those are the conversations that this gives them the option to not sit in. And so I think that that's what the goal of this bill is. And so thank you very much for your consideration of it. And thank you to the AFL-CIO for bringing it forward.
Thank you for your testimony. And thank you for being here today. Next, we'll call Dave Fiskum and Andy Easton and Jenna Kaluza. Please come forward, and whichever of you gets here first, please feel free to go ahead.
Madam Chair, good afternoon, committee members. For the record, my name is Dave Fiske. I'm here representing Providence Health System, which is, as some of you know, a major health system in this state with operations throughout urban and rural Oregon. In all, we have more than 15,000 employees on our payroll, and they obviously constitute a huge resource for our company, our organization. We respect highly the work they do every day, and we work together with them, and they, in fact, are a huge resource for the public as they deliver health services from a sense, a deep-seated sense of mission. I say this to indicate that we have an important stake in such a bill as Senate Bill 519. I have distributed to you. We have serious concerns about it, and I won't repeat the comments made so far. We would endorse many of the things that have been said to you by others who oppose this bill. I have delivered to you, or being delivered now, a letter signed by Elizabeth McCabe, Chief Mission Integration Officer for our system, and I'm just going to read a couple excerpts of that quickly, knowing, Madam Chair, that you're pressed for time this afternoon. Guided by our mission and core values, Providence seeks to nourish and promote these values along with an understanding of our rich heritage in a variety of ways, including employee orientation and education. We believe that organizational and personal values are essential to build a work environment that supports our employees in their efforts to provide service to Oregonians each and every day. Simply a right to exercise free speech, Providence views communication with our employees as an indispensable part of who we are and what our employees and our patients value. When we meet with employees, they often ask about legislative issues or ballot measures relating to health care, and you know that there are a number of those that are of concern or interest to them. As a mission-driven organization, we have a long history of advocating for legislation dealing with marginalized or uninsured to make sure they receive care and services. And we frequently advocate for the underserved, and employees want to be informed about our decisions. And I would submit to you that based on the wording of Senate Bill 519 in some particular regards, there are confusing sections of this relative to our ability to continue the sense of direction and communication that Ms. McCabe describes in her letter to you. Be happy to answer questions about that if you have any questions and cite to you specific questions we have about the legislation. But, Madam Chair, with that comment, I will yield to my colleagues to my right and be pleased to answer your questions. Thank you.
Please go ahead.
Thank you. Chair Rosenbaum and members of the committee, I'm Andy Easton, Director of Advocacy for the Oregon Hospital Association. And we are here today in opposition of Senate Bill 519. You have heard a lot of our concerns from previous speakers, so I just want to illustrate an example of how 519, excuse me, how we believe 519 would impact our ability to talk to some of our members. In 2007, the legislature sent out to the ballot Healthy Kids Initiative. It became ballot measure 50. The Hospital Association, along with many others, including the proponents of this bill, sat on a steering committee. Because of our leadership on that steering committee, we engaged our members, which in turn engaged their employees. We did that through communications, through meetings. We let them know about our position. We educated them on how the ballot measure would impact the hospital and how it would impact their ability, the children's ability to seek health care. But we also let them know the role that the hospital was playing in there. So that gave some more emphasis to it. We believe that under Senate Bill 519, our ability to talk to our employees about the religious and political issues, including ballot measures, would be impaired.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jenna Kaluza, and I'm the new state director for NFIB. NFIB represents over 7,000 member businesses in the state of Oregon, and our average business has 8 employees or less. I'm here today in opposition to Senate Bill 519 for many of the same reasons that my colleagues have addressed. In the interest of time, I won't repeat those, but a few that I'd like to reiterate. As a gentleman from the Farm Bureau spoke to, my members often have meetings with their employees and are asked questions that will be prohibited by Senate Bill 519. Often with small businesses, the employees are relying on their employers for guidance, and this communication will no longer be allowed. We don't see this as something that will benefit businesses or employees, but instead get in the way of their communication. The National Labor Relations Act already guarantees the rights of unions to communicate to employees. Under NLRA, employer-to-employee communication about unionization is already strictly regulated. While labor representatives can communicate freely, employers are prevented from doing so. Thank you for your time today. I'm available for questions. I think the last point that I wanted to touch on is I'm not an expert in the federal law, but I think from what my colleagues have spoke to me about, we would probably agree that we're not certain that if this was to pass, it would hold up in the courts and would likely be a lengthy and expensive procedure. Thank you.
Questions for these witnesses? Yes, Senator Pruszynski.
Thank you. Dave, Providence Health, is that a religious-based organization?
Senator Rosenbaum, Senator Pruszynski, the way I'd answer your question is probably in one word, yes. We are affiliated with the Catholic Church. We have been for a number of years. We are not a religious organization. However, as I use the term, we are a healthcare provider, healthcare system. We have both 7 hospitals around the state, as well as a major insurance arm and special programs. So we think of ourselves as a healthcare provider, which has a sense of mission and roots and heritage in the Catholic Church.
Right, thank you. And Jenna, could you please point out in Senate Bill 519 where it says that an employer would not be able to engage in a conversation with an employee who was asking questions about to either political or religious or any other type of matters that you think prohibit it?
Yes, I think that what I'm referring to, I did have a copy of the bill and now I can't find it, is the section that Senator Mona Sanderson was speaking to earlier, and that in a meeting that's typically held for in a business, a regular business environment, maybe there are something that you need to distribute to your employees during that meeting that your employees need to be at. If a question was raised, I think for an employer, if this was passed, I think they would probably be afraid to answer it if it had anything to do with union organization or a current political question, if it was during an election cycle or maybe during session now. And I think that was section two, line 24, meetings or communication with the employer or the agent.
Did you read the first part of that subsection where it says who declines to attend or participate?
Yes.
And wouldn't you say that if the employee asked a question, that that's a implied participation, that I'm actually wanting to engage the employer?
Senator Prezansky, I do think that, but I also think that when there's a private conversation or often with our small businesses, there might be one or two people in the room max, and if that's not on a formal record, it might, in a court, not hold up. It might be one person versus another, and I think that what this would create more so would be fear as an employer to ever communicate anything with your employees and fear that you're going to be sued.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam?
Oh, yes. Did you have a comment?
Oh, just one quick comment, but I'll yield to Senator Mona Sanderson, obviously.
Senator Mona Sanderson, please.
Well, I want to go back to what Andy, Ms. Easton was talking about regarding employer or the Healthy Kids initiative. And I'm interpreting this that if you had an employee that was against that initiative, you wouldn't have disciplined them. I mean, this is just allowing someone who doesn't want to participate to not be able to, they don't have to participate. So I would still think that the organizations can still go along with getting involved in campaigns for legislation and or whatever else. So I still think that that's okay. It's just for those employees who are not comfortable in doing that.
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Mona Sanderson, I agree with you. I do think there is fear if this was to go into place from our hospitals that there might be employees who are attending a regular staff meeting that this issue came up, a political issue came up, that they would be very sensitive about talking about it, that they may refrain from talking about it and sharing it with their employees, with the fear that they may be penalized with some of these penalties in this bill.
And Dave, I'll let you respond, but I do want to point out that the language of the bill that we were just looking at says the primary purpose of the meeting has to be to communicate the employer's opinion about religious or political matters. So if an incidental question came up in the course of a regular staff meeting that was about other matters, certainly this language wouldn't cover that situation. And I would assume that if somebody was sitting in a meeting and your only purpose was to tell them how to vote on ballot measures, which I don't even think employers generally do because I don't think it's legal to do that, and somebody said, I don't want to sit here and be told how to vote, that you would probably let them go back to work and do their job. But please, Dave, go ahead.
Madam Chair, I just want to make a quick comment, and this is a little bit risky in the sense that it may be anticipating where Senator Prezansky was going with his question for me, and I guess what I would say, and I have about four citations in this bill, which I think are troublesome from the standpoint of the words used. They all may be subsidiary to a basic question you will be facing, which is there preemption? But that said, the exemption or exception or whatever the word is outlined on page 2, starting on line 17 and down into sub F, dealing with not designed to prohibit communications of information about religious or political matters that the employer, and then there's the phrase, is required by law to communicate. At the moment, Senator Pozanski, if this is where you were heading in terms of whether that applies to province health system, we don't just and only communicate about certain religious convictions and principles and history and heritage and political issues when we are required by law to do so. We often do so at our own initiative in such examples as, for instance, the employee orientations, which any new employee is required to attend. If a new employee, to anticipate another question that could be asked, is required to attend that and doesn't, we surely are not engaged in discharge or firing. We would probably be engaged from an employment standpoint in what I would label, for want of a better label, progressive discipline. Thus, if you go back to page one, there is the use of the word discipline that we are prevented from engaging in, and that's not our goal. This happens very rarely, if ever. I'm unaware of specific situations where that happens, but we think there are problems subsidiary to the preemption question, the constitutional questions you've heard from others. There are problems with the very language that creates a lot of confusion for us as to what we're, as an employer, permitted to do and not do from both religious and political standpoints. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank all of you for your testimony.
Thank you very much.
And I think the only person remaining on the sign-up sheet before we take other comments for people who might have arrived late is Bill Perry. So if you'll please come forward, Bill.
Madam Chair, as Mr. Perry comes forward, I'm wondering if staff can also get us copies of the actual law that the Washington opinion is referring to. There's a Senate bill and a House bill. I think we just need a copy of one of those.
We'll get that to you as soon as we can. Good afternoon.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee. For the record, Bill Perry at the Oregon Restaurant Association. We have some small issues around the industry, but I think one particular set of concerns for us, and Senator Pozanski can tell me whether or not my fear is real. We actually, if you look at the tipped employee portion of our industry, we have a high amount of mandatory meetings because of the liability we carry for non-reported tips, and because tipped employees tend not to want to take their mandatory breaks. And so if we get audited either by IRS or by BOLI, we have to show that we've had mandatory meetings where we've described it. We have to have payroll stuffers. We have a lot of different things. Now, because of the nature of the turnover of the average tipped employee, we have about an 80% turnover annually, and we have many tipped employees in these establishments. So the exposure for lawsuits is high in that particular part of the industry where we have to have mandatory meetings from a liability standpoint. Okay, as this body dealt with, and all of you but one voted for last time, we have bills as it relates to tipped employees on meal breaks last session, which was talked about a lot in these mandatory meetings. We probably could have done them differently, but generally there are a lot of issues as it relates to tipped employees that happen in courts is around tip pooling in the federal government that deals a lot with tips and law changes, and we have meetings down here. So as it relates to statutory or political matters, it's not from a party standpoint, but from a legislative or congressional standpoint, there are a lot of political issues that are discussed in these mandatory meetings. And we could probably break and do some other things, but I don't think that will happen. And I do think there's a high amount of exposure if the political legislative part is left in this bill as it relates to our industry. Is my concern real?
Normally we get to ask the questions. Senator Pozanski, did you want to respond to that question?
Yeah, I would say, Bill, based on what you're saying, if you have a restaurant that's having a mandatory meeting regarding issues around work and how they have to comply with the law and what the rules require, I don't see where you're violating the law. It's, to me, it really does come down to those few lines in Section 2, whether the employer is requiring someone to be there and forcing them to listen to communication from the employer, where their sole purpose of that meeting is to do these things that would be prohibited under the bill, not what is required by law as to what is going to be required for tax purposes, reporting tips, etc.
Senator Brzezinski, I mean, like I said, the reason is that I do think there's a lot of legislative actions that are discussed in this bill, and many a times we're doing it for the benefit of the employee, but the employee doesn't know that they're going on. Like I used the example of the meal breaks last time, which you participated in. We actually handed out sheets that were then given to Commissioner Gardner to ask him to support the bill and in support of the rules, and they weren't required to sign the sheet of paper, obviously, but they were required generally in a lot of those meetings to be at the meeting because we started it off from a tip reporting and a meal break. Sometimes we were laying those. So that generally is the premise of the requiring the meeting, but there are issues that are discussed outside of that as it relates around federal and state action for tipped employees specifically. So I just think that the way it reads with legislative and political activity, that could be used. And obviously with a high amount of turnover, I don't think any of them would ever complain why they're employment there. But, you know, if I have an 80% turnover, that means I've got a high exposure to them using. Is that one of the reasons that they might have been discharged?
Now, clearly it's a gray area. Yeah. There's a fine line as to what and how it's actually presented to the employee as to what the purpose of the meeting is and what information you're giving to them. I mean, that's clear, and that's the whole thing. I understand from what I'm hearing from most of the opposition is the concern that there could be some type of reaction from an employee that would, in fact, cause some type of labor dispute to be filed, and that could mean that I could be liable for this or that. I mean, yeah, there's all those ifs that are possible, but I say those are there right now as to if someone is not in this context. But there could be an assertion that something that the employer is prohibited from doing, that a false claim is filed.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. Mm-hmm. That completes the list of people who signed up to testify. Is there anybody else who wants to testify on Senate Bill 519? Okay, seeing no one, members, there also should be in front of you written testimony from Jim Wilson, also a statement from Hillary Mortensen, and then an additional statement from Marcy Putnam, and we will also enter all of those written statements into the record. And with nothing further to come before us today, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 519, and members, we are adjourned.